Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin declared while hosting his Israeli counterpart, the U.S.-Israel military relationship is unshakable as Israel continues its slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza. The historical record notes the American administration is a named co-conspirator to genocide. Crosstalking Palestine, I'm joined by my guest Lionel in New York. He is a legal and media analyst. In Ottawa, we have Arti Imsis. He is a professor of international law at Queen's University, as well as author of The United Nations and the Question of Palestine. And in Amman, we have Nasser Abu Nasser. He is a BRICS ambassador to Jordan and the Middle East. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Professor, if I can go to you first in Ottawa, this is your area of expertise, the law, and how the international community has dealt with the Palestine question. I think international law has been made into a complete mockery. It doesn't stand for anything anymore. If there are exceptions, then why do we have laws? The American approach to this quote-unquote non-binding resolution, which, correct me if I'm wrong, sir, but I mean, when the United Nations Security Council has a resolution and votes on it, it becomes international law. How can the Americans make that exception? While at the same time not voiding the entire process? Go ahead, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me. Well, how to put this delicately? The U.S. position is complete nonsense, as your question suggested. Under Article 25 of the United Nations Charter, members of the United Nations agree to accept and carry out the decisions of the Council. And as has been confirmed by the International Court of Justice, specifically in its 1971 advisory opinion on Namibia, such decisions need not take the place within Chapter 7 of the Charter, which some commentators are asserting, and they cover all decisions of the Council. So Resolution 2728, which calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, is one such decision, and it therefore binds all parties to the conflict, but in particular Israel, because it is a member state of the United Nations.
Well, Nasser and Amman, drawing on what we just heard from the professor in Ottawa, even though the United States abstained, it's incumbent upon the United States to take action if Israel does not take action and stop its slaughter in Gaza. The U.S. is obligated by this resolution, even though they abstain from it, to intervene if necessary, by all means necessary. Nasser.
Thank you, first of all, for having me. And I want to say first that the U.S. was part of this huge massacre and slaughter in Gaza. The main thing is that this resolution from the Security Council is obligatory by law, but the U.S. was actually covering Israel, not just starting from the October the 7th, but for the last 100 years since the beginning of this huge genocide. Actually, the holistic West was actually covering Israel because Israel is a colonial project in the Middle East. They planted this project and they are covering it and they are aiding it, not just with the political aid and in the international community, but also by aiding them with weapons, by aiding them with the high tech that can lead for more and more Palestinian casualties. Because the genocide and the ethnical cleansing of Palestine is part of the Western culture. It's part of the colonial Western culture that actually created Israel to serve those goals.
Well, you know, Lionel likes to refer to himself as the guy in the fishbowl on this program, and I appreciate it very much. But Lionel, if you look at what happened in the United Nations, and this is not the first time there was an attempt at a resolution calling for a ceasefire, the United States and Israel is all alone. Is there any awareness? You're in New York. Is there any awareness of that? And if there is an awareness, do people care?
No. To answer your question, going back historically, do you remember, gentlemen, around the turn of the 20th century, they had these bare-knuckled boxers who would do this a lot, and they would, Jack Johnson, and they would do this, they never would land a punch on anybody, but it looked great. That's the UN. I'm a lawyer by profession, and I'm not an international lawyer. And one time I was asking, why is this not enforced? And when I read the fine print, it says, this is merely aspirational. I'm thinking, well, what's the point of this? So what we're doing is we're having gobbledygook. And not only that, we're having this kabuki dance, this theater, this synchronized scrum where people stand with arms akimbo and says, why you?
Yeah, but, the resolution wasn't aspirational. I mean, English is my first language. I understood it. It's pretty clear, okay? It's not aspirational. It is a demand.
But there's no enforcement.
Well, no, that was my question to our guest, right, in Amman, is that, no, it's passed. The United States must take action. It must cut off all aid. It must cut off all diplomatic cover. And if it may, even if it has to use military force, it has to enforce the resolution, okay? And then when you have the ambassador saying, I mean, the audacity, saying, well, this was non-binding. Nobody else in the room knew that. Lionel.
But the next question is, fine, who enforces it? If you go back and you say, excuse me, we must now let's all vote for enforcement, if that were even possible, how would it occur? And what are the mechanisms in place to do it? And if you don't have it, then it's merely aspirational. It's a theoretical body.
Well, then, go ahead.
If I might just come in on Lionel's point, I actually take his point seriously. A good number of my students regularly ask whether or not, and this goes to the point that Lionel's making, if international law is indeed law, in the absence of, say, for instance, a centralized enforcement mechanism that we would have at most municipal or domestic systems, however can it be said that this law, which is binding, is indeed law and binding? And so that's a fair question to ask, but then one needs to assess or take account of the fact that international law doesn't operate in the same way that our domestic legal systems do. There is no centralized enforcement mechanism. What we do have are various mechanisms, one of which is the Security Council of the United Nations, who does have the authority to pass binding resolutions on all member states of the United Nations under Article 25 of the UN Charter. And in this case, we have a resolution of the Council demanding, that is obligatory, a ceasefire. And so to the extent that Israel is violating that demand to a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, there's no question that as a matter of international law, they are derelict. They're violating that law. The next question is, as Lionel has mentioned, well, what next? And so the next question is moving to the Council again for more teeth. A resolution that would be passed at the Council, which would provide for sanctions on Israel for failing to abide by its international legal obligations under Resolution 2728 and so on. And so while, as we say, under domestic law, we have direct systems of enforcement, under international law, they're less direct, but they exist nonetheless. And simply because Israel, an outlier, and the United States, also an outlier on this question, are violating the law, it doesn't mean the law doesn't exist. It does exist. And the Palestinian people are experiencing the result of the failure to abide by this international law in their person. Some 32,000 or more dead, killed rather, some 70,000 or more injured, and 1.7 million, that's 85% of the population of the Gaza Strip, forcibly transferred, all of them indiscriminately bombarded, starvation being used as a tool against them. These are serious matters. Now, the principal judicial organ of the United Nations has said all of this amounts to a plausible genocide. And well, so action must be taken by states. They all have obligations to prevent genocide. These are positive obligations. They exist for the United States. They exist for Canada, where I'm sitting. They exist for every member of the Genocide Convention, and so on. So action can be taken. We just need the political will to get moving.
Yeah, but Nasser, inaction is culpability as well. I've titled this program Genocide in Arms. And if I can go back to my introduction with Lloyd Austin, you know, unshakable. I mean, that is pleading guilty to the actions of your co-conspirator in the Middle East, and that's Israel.
I totally agree. Actually, the U.S. is part of this ongoing genocide. What happened between Gallant and Lloyd Austin, actually, Gallant gave him a list of the weapons that he wanted to bring to Israel during his visit. That means, actually, that the U.S. is actually just pissing off all the resolutions that came out of the Security Council. This is first. Second, we need to check the real and the fact and the actual U.S. political course in since the October 7th until now. More than 240 ships were actually carried off. All kinds of weapons were sent to Israel. Also, you can just check the other figures. They sent more than 2,000 Navy personnel in order to, you know, aid Israel directly in this war. So if we want to be honest and to be frank with all our audience, we have to say that the U.S. is taking part and they're part of this ongoing genocide is a full partner. This is the only description that we can describe the U.S. actions since the October 7th until now. And actually, if we want to return back in history, America and the U.S. just guaranteed that Israel will always maintain what we can describe as advanced military aid all over the region in order not just to, you know, secure or to give Israel, as they say, the right of defense, but to ensure that they are dominating the whole area and no one will ever actually...
Yeah, but the problem with Nasser with that is that when that hegemony is challenged, then the United States is... It's putting itself into a position where it has to fight all of Israel's enemies. And that's exactly what the government in Israel wants. Netanyahu wants the United States to fight its wars for it. Do you agree with me?
Yes, of course. I agree with you. But the thing is how they will fight it. Biden wants a different version of how we will achieve those goals. So there is actually one ideology. It's an imperialist ideology in the Middle East, and Israel is the one who's leading the Western actions in the Middle East. But the thing is, Biden...
Nasser, hold that thought. We have to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Palestine. Stay with our team. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing Palestine. You know, Lionel, let's go back to Lionel in New York. One of the things that's it really weighs heavy, it should weigh heavy on all of us here, is that particularly in the United States, but through the rest of the world in general, but in the United States, all of this is the genocide. They won't use the word, of course, they're not allowed to. But all of what's going on is all couched in election calculations. You know, Biden's going to lose Michigan. Who could lose? And I find it almost takes the life out of me. I mean, here tens of thousands of people are being killed and they're worried about which direction one congressional district might go. I mean, that is just so hollow. It shows how hollowed out Western society is. Lionel.
This week was one of the biggest fundraisers ever at Radio City Music Hall with Obama and Clinton, and they're going to raise $10, $20 million. The Democratic Party has been absolutely dead, moribund, in a coma. And here's the best part, and Peter, you and I have talked about this before. The people... This is so schizophrenic for me. The people that I used to dismiss as being my political and antipodal opposite or whatever, I'm now listening who make more sense. I read something to a friend of mine, was one of the most cogent answers regarding what the American responsibility is to the saving of lives, children, and people starving. And I read it and I said, guess who said that? Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC.
The same thing has happened to me over the last, particularly the last few news cycles, yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, the rise of platforms. This week also in New York, in Baltimore, there was a bridge collapse. And Biden said, we will put this together. We will pay for this. So people ask, where are you getting the money for this? And we all said, aha, good question. Isn't it funny when it comes to our infrastructure? And by the way, this is very domestic, gentlemen. I don't mean to bore you. But to show you, there's this question that people should be asking is, where do we get money to support ourselves here? Where is the Democratic response? And Peter, you and I are from a generation where the left, the progressive left, were prototypically, almost archetypically, anti-war. Yeah. And finally, I'm saying, if you just could replace the word Israel with, let's say, France or Scotland, and if you said, how could France do this, there would be a completely different discussion. Forget the word genocide. So what we're doing is, again, I'm living in a fishbowl, but the Democratic Party, the Republicans are very clear. They're absolutely adamant. They're consistent. But the Democrats are schizophrenic, and this will be the chance for the Republicans to seize upon that, to form a schism. They won't even do it.
Yeah, but Lionel, the downside of that is more Republicans are pro-Israel than Palestine. So be careful what you hope for. Professor in Ottawa, you know, one of the things that's very unsettling for me as an American coming from the West is that, you know, the West is... come to terms in many ways with its colonial settler projects around the world, and they lay their face in shame. There's talk of reparations about how countries, peoples all around the world recover from colonialism, imperialism. But it's the West, and almost exclusively the West, that is promoting a settler colonialist project in the Middle East. And nobody in the West likes to talk about it. It's too uncomfortable. You know, I mean, again, Lionel and I, as Americans, you know, what we did to the Native Americans was shameful. It was slaughter. We didn't use the word genocide, but that's what it was. But the West now is just flipped and saying, well, this project is okay. Professor.
A very good point. And in fact, as a Canadian, we have undergone very much the same, if you like, transition. The representation of what Canada has done to the First Nations people, the Indigenous people in Canada, has been effectively whitewashed, where now we're sad and feel poorly about it in the public, but little is done to assist the situation of real people on the ground living in poverty here in Canada who are First Nations. And so this has given rise to my view that a lot of this concern for the settler colonial project or reconciliation with what we have done in the quote unquote new world is performative. And we have proof of that, not only by how we treat how states in Canada, the United States and other settler colonies treat their First Nations people, but our foreign policies as well in respect of the natives of Palestine, where an indigenous population is very clearly and in real time and continually since 1947 undergoing a process of ethnic cleansing, of displacement on the one hand, and replacement on the other by folks who want to take their land and resources. Take, for instance, the very many public statements made, not merely statements, but actions taken by Israeli leaders who indicate that once Gaza is ethnically cleansed, once the Palestinian population, all 2.2 million of them, are driven into the Sinai or driven south somewhere, or perhaps even into the sea, that they'll take over their land and build properties and resettle the Gaza Strip and so on. So as you rightly point out, there's a continuum here, and it is no a wonder why Israel's staunchest supporters in the Gaza matter now are the settler colonies of the West, the United States, Canada, and so on. That needs to be called out, and I'm glad you put that question to us. But I do think that it is self-evident for a lot of folks in the Global South, certainly the Namibians, certainly the South Africans who've taken this case before the International Court of Justice on genocide and so on. So we're at an inflection point. Gaza has provided an inflection point in international relations, driving a wedge between the Global South, who can see what's actually happening on the ground in Gaza, and to the beleaguered Gazan Palestinian population, and the small countries, the smaller numbered countries, but far more powerful in the industrialized West.
Yeah, Nasser, one of the most pathetic things, I mean, almost a half a year of just unbelievable tragedy, and for the most part, the elites in the West turn their face away. They don't want to see it, okay? If I don't see it, then they're not culpable. Well, everybody can see it, all right? Jared Kushner, the son-in-law of Donald Trump, his comments, it was in the Telegraph, he was at the Kennedy School, and he just talked about the Palestine question as if it was just a real estate issue.
Yeah.
Yes, I saw that video and I was just not shocked at all because it's an entirely that had been actually we were actually living under for the past 100 years, because this area is an open space for all kind of, you know, absorbing resources, just making more profit. And for them, we're just not humans. Dehumanizing us makes this land an open land for new settlers who will gain and make more money in the name of the Western civilization, which is actually not just, you know, silly, but it's actually, it's just, it's, I can't imagine someone is just, can just talk about the properties of the Gazans, people who were actually killed systematically for the past 6 months, and just joke so easily about it. And it is like, you know, a commercial project where this land is, you know, gonna bring more investments for the Israelis. And that's why they should and they have to, you know, occupy this, you know, rich coast. And he just forgot to tell the students at the school that there were more than 1,700,000 Palestinians are locked in the same area. Actually, what he's proposing is, let us just participate fully because there is a profits and money that we are going to...
All the more so is that...
700,000 Palestinians.
All the more so since most of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, they've already been displaced, sometimes many, many times. I mean, you keep pushing them that way. I mean, it is really extraordinary. You know, Lionel, you know, you and I have known each other for a very long time, and, you know, we've sarcastically ripped apart this whole woke culture. You know, I'm a victim, you're a victim, who's a victim on the totem pole and all that. But remarkably, Palestinians are not victims, are they? It's just amazing to me how the left, particularly in the left, they can go down the totem pole of who's been victimized, but the Palestinians are just not there. You can't see them. We're not allowed to see them. Lionel.
Yeah. If ever, you know, Peter, we always, well, we, the right always speaks of this mythical, magical, incredible wizard, Saul Alinsky, and how he created this, the dialectic. And let me tell you the way it works here. It's very, very simple. And you can watch any television show or any kind of attempt at discussing it. You will ask the question, do you recognize that Hamas is a terrorist organization? Do you believe that that Israel has the right to defend itself? And then for some reason, it just stops. And so everything began on October the 7th. And that's the launching point. What would you do? What if you say, wait a minute, that doesn't even begin to even remotely. But see, Peter and gentlemen, as you know, in our culture, you have a 1 minute block. If you're lucky on any major cable news, a lot of air quotes here, news, and that's as far as it goes. Do you know what it's like for anybody to say, let me give you 75 years plus of not truth, but perspective? There's no time for that. It's, look, that's a tough place. They've got to defend themselves. And we invoke 9/11.
And what if somebody told them? And it's time and memorial. There have been enemies here. Let me finish off with the professor.
Why don't I just get in on that, though? Just to go back, Peter, with the point that you'd made. Palestinians being able to represent themselves. This has been a classic problem. And Edward Said put it very, very well when he asked, tongue-in-cheek, for permission to narrate. Situation for Palestine is simple. As you'd mentioned, in the Gaza Strip, 75% of the population are themselves not Gazan. They're Palestine refugees who originate from areas that became the State of Israel in 1947, 48, 49, and are only in the Gaza Strip in forced exile because they're not Jewish, because the State That's of Israel right. is prohibiting their ability to return, their right to return to their homes, from which they were forcibly displaced.
Professor, I'm sorry, I have to jump in here on this very salient point, but we've run out of time. I want to thank my guests in Ottawa, New York, and Amman. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.